From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's The Screen Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment, our relationships with, and impacts upon it. Good morning, I'm Kyle McGuire, Assistant Program Director here at KPCW. Today, Nell and Chris are picking out two of their favorite interviews from the past couple of years. Both of these interviews feature authors whose books deal with the relationships man has with nature and the environment. The first interview today will be a replay from April 16th, 2019, with Kirk Wallace Johnson about his book, The Feather Thief: Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. It's a story about one man's obsession with tying fish flies and his stealing of rare exotic birds from a museum to support that obsession. In the second part of the show, author Earl Swift talks about his book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of the Vanishing Tangier Island. The book covers the author's time spent on a small island in the Chesapeake Bay that is literally disappearing due to rising sea levels, storm-related erosion, and changes in community culture. That interview was from September 18th, 2018. Our relationship with and impacts upon the environment, that's what this Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Kirk, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us how you happened upon this story. Before we dig into the tale here, tell us how you came upon this strange story.
Well, I was at a completely different place in my life. I was in the midst of an 8-year battle with the U.S. government on behalf of tens of thousands of Iraqi refugees who had been hunted because they're seen as traitors for helping the Americans during the war. I was over there. I was the U.S. government official in charge of trying to rebuild the city of Fallujah. And when I got back to the States, a number of my Iraqi colleagues were killed and others were driven from the country, and I kind of tumbled into this cause trying to get them to safety. And as the years stacked up and the pressures mounted, I found that the only real escape that I could get from all of it, and the real peace of mind I could get, came from fly fishing. And so whenever I had a free day, I would throw my gear into the trunk of the car, and at the time, I was living in New England, and I would shoot up to Vermont or New Hampshire and just fish all day. And 8 years ago, I was in northern New Mexico, and I hired a guide to show me the ropes of this local river. And like halfway through the day, as he's opening up his fly box to tie a new trout fly on the line, I caught a glimpse of this stunning-looking thing that I'd never seen before. And it was one of these Victorian salmon flies. It was crimson and iridescent green and canary yellow, and I started peppering him with questions about it, because for any of your listeners that know the world of trout fishing, that trout flies are not pretty things by any measure.
Right.
They're made to be functional. This didn't seem like any insect I'd ever seen on the planet. After I'm kind of peppering him with all these questions, at some point he said, well, if you think that's strange, you should hear about this kid that broke into the British Museum, stole $1 million worth of exotic birds so that he could pluck these feathers and sell them for hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to buy a golden flute. And as he was saying this impossibly strange story, I mean, as it was happening, my brain kind of lit up, where I was like, this is the weirdest story I've ever heard. There must be more to it. And that's really where this all began.
And so, I mean, I think it does sound strange to so many people when you hear that somebody risked, you know, life and limb and jail time and reputation to break in to, you know, a British National Museum and steal feathers, you know? So tell us about kind of what it was that he particularly had his eye on, and a little bit more about why.
Sure. Well, so the Victorian art of salmon fly tying kind of coincides with this huge story about our relationship to the planet and to the natural world. All of this really began in the peak of what was known as the feather fever, but where women were competing to wear exotic birds in their hat and in their piled hair. And they think all of this started when Marie Antoinette wedged a diamond-encrusted feather into her hair and kicked off this kind of global almost like an arms race where women were competing to wear the more rare birds on their hats. Historians have said that that's the single largest direct extermination of wildlife in the history of the planet, and it had a central role in birthing the modern conservation movement, was to protect birds from being fully exterminated for fashion. And at the same time that all that was happening, these British aristocrats who were, you know, had their private clubs on these rivers in Scotland and Wales and elsewhere, were using those same birds and plucking the same feathers to tie these really beautiful and ornate patterns, or recipes they're called. And they have these names like the Jock Scott and Exordium and the Green Highlander. But crucially, I mean, salmon are essentially colorblind when they're spawning. They're certainly not feeding either. And so there's no biological basis for any of this. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why a salmon in Scotland would ever meet, much less be drawn to a feather from a bird of paradise from the highlands of New Guinea. This is purely on the plane of artifice. But Edwin Rist, the feather thief at the center of this story, started tying these flies at a very young age, at 10 or 11 years old. And within a few years of his first fly, he was hailed as the future of fly tying by this community, by its publication. And he would go around the country competing in these tournaments and taking first prize for his flawless creations. But the problem was that he could never afford the quote-unquote real feathers, the ones that came from these exotic birds, because whenever they occasionally popped up on eBay or elsewhere, they were always bought by wealthier, older men who could afford this. And we're just, so you know, like, I mean, we're talking about a 5 or 6 feathers the size of your pinky fingernail go for maybe $100.
Wow. I think you said in the book.
I mean, there are some flies that require $2,000 worth of feathers to tie just one of them.
Right. Much more valuable than gold, right?
Per ounce. Yeah. I mean, but it's just a small kind of very intense demand within this community, because the guys that do this today, and it's almost exclusively men, have kind of like consecrated these recipes from the Victorian era almost with like a religious reverence. They feel like they have to tie them exactly the way they were tied back then. And so Edwin, when he was accepted to study at the Royal Academy of Music in London, got a call from one of his mentors saying, you've got to get to this British Museum. You've got to see these birds no matter what. And so he under false pretenses, wrote and said that he was a student photographer and he just wanted to see the birds. And they gave him access. This is the second largest ornithological collection on the face of the planet, 750,000 bird skins, which have been used for countless scientific study over the generations. And they let him in, and he took a lot of pictures of the birds, but he also took pictures of the windows and the entry and exit points, and he was basically casing the place from his first visit. And it took about 8 months of planning, so in between rehearsals and concerts and class, he ordered a diamond blade glass cutter and wire cutters, and he ordered thousands of little Ziploc bags that he would eventually use to sell these things off to this community.
I like the fact that he also opened up a file, created a file on his laptop titled something along the lines, Mission to Invade the Tring Museum, or something along those lines.
It was actually planned for museum invasion dot dot. So
invasion.
When the cops found that on his computer, it wasn't the best look. but he, you know, the thing is that these specimens, we understand evolution through natural selection because of this collection. we can definitively prove that mercury levels are rising in the oceans because we have these collections, that we can, the scientists can pluck a feather from a seabird that was gathered in 1820 and compare it to the same species gathered from the same island in 1850, in 1890, in 1930, and we can show that mercury levels are rising. I mean, we could spend hours just talking about how these things have been deployed to advance human knowledge, and knowledge that not just helps humans, but helps the planet. The people who collected this and who have protected these specimens for literally hundreds of years have understood that they hold answers to questions that scientists haven't even thought to ask yet. Mm-hmm. But to this community, because there's such a reverence for the beauty of these feathers, on the black market, what he stole was roughly worth about $1 million.
Wow.
And so when he
all shoved
when
into
he
one
finally
suitcase,
showed up at
right?
the museum, he wheeled an empty suitcase up this alleyway behind the museum, scaled the wall, snipped away some barbed wire, broke the window out, and I think he had something like 3 or 4 hours in the museum. The guard was allegedly distracted by watching a soccer game. And he crawled back out the window. He came in and went back to his dorm room and started plucking the feathers, and he had a ravenous market to sell to. There were Americans hopping planes to fly to London to buy this stolen stuff.
Well, unknowing, but they obviously didn't know that this was stolen property.
Some of them, it kind of beggars belief that they wouldn't know. I mean, it requires a certain convenient ignorance not to ask the question, how does a 20-year-old college student suddenly sit, how is he suddenly sitting on $1 million worth of birds?
Yeah.
I mean, some of the specimens that he stole have not appeared on the fly tying marketplace for decades. Edwin stole, I think it was all 17, might have been 17 or 19. He stole every one of the museum's flame bower birds. And if your listeners have ever seen this incredible bird, it, part of its mating dance is that it kind of drops one wing almost like a matador, and it dilates its pupils in an alternating way. It's very hypnotic.
Right.
And the 19 birds that he stole were constituted not only the entire collection from that museum, but there were something only like 30 of those birds in all of the museums in the planet. And so in one fell swoop, it's a huge hole in the scientific record. And so, what he told me, what the feather thief told me, was that most of his customers knew enough not to ask questions.
Right.
And that if they needed a convenient cover story, then he would give them one, that he just, he found it at an estate sale or something like that.
Right.
And, as you kind of alluded to, like, some aspects of this crime are, like, comedic. I mean, this is like a 20-year-old kid throwing a rock through a window, lugging a rolling suitcase into a museum, and hanging out there for hours.
Missing the train. missing the last train back to London. So he spent the night at a train station or walking around Tring.
With $1 million in
his
suitcase.
And then the museum didn't know what was missing for almost a year, correct? Or not a year, but
yeah,
quite a period of time.
Initially, when the following morning, they found the broken glass, and they raced to make sure that Darwin's birds were all still in place, and then they just kind of were driven by wishful thinking, but they concluded that it must have been someone who was just like doing a smash and grab, looking for laptops or iPads or things like that.
Hmm.
There are, in the museum's defense, there are, with a collection this big, I mean, they have, I think, almost 3 miles of specimens just in spirit in preserved jars. They have 1,500 cabinets with 20 or 30 drawers in each. I mean, it takes weeks for them to do an entire inventory check at a minimum. And so but in this case, they just thought someone broke the window out and then left.
Hmm.
It wasn't until 35 days later that someone pulled open one of the cabinets expecting to find, you know, 50 birds, and they found nothing. And then they started pulling open drawer after drawer after drawer and realizing the huge extent of this loss. But crucially, because it was 35 days, the CCTV footage had expired 28 days after the heist. And wow. So even if Edwin had left any kind of, you know, leads by video, that those had already been sort of overwritten.
That's what's kind of amazing to me, Kirk, that if there's a rock through your window, your security alarm goes off, that it would take you 35 days to look at the CCTV, to finally say, hey, maybe we should look at the CCTV video. Wouldn't that be something you would do day one? I know this down, you know, a separate path, but that just seemed to be, like Nell says, a collection of comedic, almost comedic errors that occur.
I know, and, you know, like, there are times where even after all these years, I still can't believe this happened because it's just so crazy to me. But at the same time, I've also tried to, you know, I get frustrated with the British Museum because there are plenty of things that I think they should have done differently. They didn't actually play any role in what eventually led to the arrest of the feather thief. They, even though he had written to them with his own name and asked to see the very birds that were later stolen. But I've tried to just keep in mind, and hopefully for the reader as well, the person who deserves blame here is the one who committed the crime, and it's tempting to blame the institution. But the British Museum, like so many natural history museums, these are public trusts, and they're not swimming in money. It's free admission to go to this place. It exists to try to just propagate human knowledge, and they're totally dependent on federal funding. And in this case, they just... I mean, I was there not too long ago for a book tour in England, and they now have a security camera up by the alleyway and by the window that was broken out, but I noticed it was pointed in the wrong direction. and so, you know, I get frustrated with them, but at the same time, I mean, that they can only work with what they have, and they're not a crime-fighting organization either, you know. In this case, their trust was really betrayed by this kid, and... they're still suffering the consequences. Trust.
Right after generations of protecting these specimens and birds through wars and moves and,
right,
you know.
Other threats. Like
other
that.
Threats, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very devastating when once you realize that not even just the lengths that naturalists went to build this collection, but that, I mean, there were something like 140,000 pounds of thermite bomb dropped on London during World War One by German Zeppelins. The Natural History Museum was back in London at the time. This collection was kept there, and it was hit 28 times during the Blitz during World War II. And that prompted the curators to marshal this fleet of unmarked trucks in the middle of the night to basically, you know, slip this collection out to this countryside museum in Tring, and it was, you know, believed that they were finally safe there. And so the fact that these birds survived, you know, World War One and Hitler's bombers and were eventually stolen by a fly tire is kind of hard to process sometimes.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kirk Wallace Johnson. He's the author of The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. So, Kirk, there's so much more we could talk about, and I have to recommend to our listeners that if they want to read more about the history of these incredible specimens that were taken, they pick up the book. But I also want to talk about your goal. So you learned about this, and then you thought, you know, I want to track down these feathers and skins and see what happened to them and see what can be recovered. And so talk to us a little bit about, like, your experience there.
Yeah, well, when I first heard about this, I did not know anything about birds. I didn't know anything about, you know, salmon fly tying. I didn't know anything about Victorian history. This was almost like a kind of secret hobby of mine, just to try to figure out what happened. So I would, you know, go and testify before Congress about what was happening in Iraq and then go back to my hotel room and log into these private feather trading forums and take screenshots of these illicit transactions. And so it was just, I had sort of a split personality while I was working on this. And then at some point, at the time it was something roughly like a third of my life I had spent trying to confront the humanitarian consequences of a war that I had never supported. And I really was kind of desperate to start moving on with my life and putting the war behind me to the extent that I could. And for whatever strange reason, but this investigation and this book kind of became almost like a personal life raft for me, in that it allowed me to tackle something much different in some respects, much lighter, even though there's some real serious implications to this heist. But I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to carry out an investigation like this. I just felt that something bad had happened here. And by the time that I heard about it, which was something like 6 months after the sentencing, at that point, Edwin never spent a night behind bars. Something like half of the birds were still at large. And from what I could tell, they were still being openly trafficked in this community.
Yeah.
They were making jokes about breaking into other museums. And so I was really just animated by this frustration that something wrong had happened and no one was looking for these things anymore. So it might as well be me.
Well, yeah, we only have like 3 or 4 more minutes. So let's get to what happens to Riss. Eventually he's caught. He immediately confesses to the crime. He has birds and feathers, skins as they're called, in his apartment. It was estimated that he took somewhere around 300 whole skins. And they recovered over half of them. He pleads guilty, but he uses, and I know we could spend another half hour on this, but he hires an attorney who is the cousin of Sacha Baron Cohen. It's just to make things more wacky, who uses an Asperger's defense. You have a minute to summarize.
Oh boy,
the use of that defense. Yeah, and
actually,
it worked.
And actually, his attorneys got him a meeting with Borat's cousin, who was a preeminent expert on Asperger's, and the Brits have kind of a soft spot when it comes to sentencing people with Asperger's, and I'm not for throwing people on the spectrum into prison or anything, but without giving away all the twists and turns of the book, he admitted something fairly shocking to me, the feather thief did, over this 8-hour interview where he, you know, basically showed me how he faked it during this assessment. This story is, it kind of just mushroomed into, craziness in every dimension. And I'm still, even since the book has come out, I'm still finding out all kinds of new shocking things to it.
Well, so we'll have to look for an addendum then, an updated version in a year or two.
Yeah, or people can, in Salt Lake at least, can Salt Lake City can come and see me in a couple of weeks when I'm over there, and I can give the update in person. Oh.
So I just wanted to mention that. Yep. So Thursday, April 25th at 7 p.m., right? You'll be at the King's English?
Yes. The 15th Street Gallery, I guess.
Yep. Okay.
Yep. With the King's English, yeah.
Yeah.
And do people need to register for this in advance or get a ticket, or they just show up at the door?
You know, I don't know. I'm assuming that's all up on their website, but
okay.
But I can't imagine they're charging that much just to see little old me if you do have to buy a ticket. So,
well, it's a fascinating book. Both Chris and I spent a significant amount of time with it before the show today, and
absolutely,
yeah, highly recommend
it. Oh, I'm honored that you had me on. It's been a lot of fun to talk about it.
Well, I'm going to be there, and I got another 8 questions for you. So I hope I know.
Great.
I'll either ask during or I'll take you aside afterwards, because it's an amazing book and so many other things we didn't get to. It's called The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century by by authors Kirk Wallace Johnson. Kirk, so thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. The next interview is from September 18th, 2018, with Earl Swift and his book Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of the Vanishing Tangier Island.
Earl, thanks so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Chris, Neil, thanks so much for having me.
Great. I thought we would break the conversation down into roughly thirds. The first third, we'll get some history and some background on Tangier Island, and then we'll move forward and talk about some of these environmental and perhaps cultural and economic challenges the island is facing, and then perhaps delve into some of the potential solutions. So first, Earl, if you could, give us a little, our listeners out here in Park City, Utah, a little background on what and who Tangier Island is.
Okay, this is a squiggle of marsh and mud 12 miles from the nearest mainland port. It's it's been settled since 1778 and is now populated by about 460 people, all but a few of whom can trace their lineage to the first settlers who arrived in the 18th century. It's essentially treeless. It's about a mile by three. Most of that, 70% or better, is salt marsh, which floods twice a day with each high tide.
Hmm.
And it is as close to being an amphibious place to live as you can probably find in the lower 48. Most of it fails to clear 3 feet above the tides. Hmm. Actually, most of it fails to clear one. It's been salt marsh.
Wow.
But even the parts of the island in which you could put up a house are just barely above the water. It's wafer thin. So it's a place that does not have a lot of elevation to give up. And since 1850, it's given up quite a bit. It's not only is the bay around it rising, as are these around the world, but the island itself, along with the entire southern Chesapeake, is subsiding. The Earth's crust there is sinking into the mantle. And that 1-2 punch of land going down and water coming up has spelled big trouble for Tangier and predictions that it will have to be abandoned within 25 years.
Wow. And give us a picture of the economic scene on the island. How do people make a living?
Well, it's all tied to the water, as you would expect. Historically, it's Tangiermen have relied on the bay and its bounty of crabs in the summer and oysters in the winter for their sustenance, and continue to do so. That is the number one source of income for the island to this day. An increasing number of islanders have decided to forego the uncertainties of crabbing and oystering and have joined the crews of tugboats that are parts of companies that are well off the, well away from the island. They're at opposite ends of the bay in Philadelphia and down in Hampton Roads. And so those folks are gone for weeks at a time. Otherwise, there's a nascent tourist industry, but the income from tourism winds up in relatively few hands, and so you really can't call that a viable way for the island to earn its keep.
So the Chesapeake, in general, seems to have suffered a number of insults, let's call them, over the decades. High nutrient loadings leading to algal blooms and then the knock-on effects to, in this case, crabbing and oyster industries. Has the island kind of weathered, the Tangier watermen weathered those challenges, or do they face similar challenges now?
I think that if you were to ask most of the bay's regular users, you'd be told that it's looking better in the past couple of years than it has. For many years prior. It's turbidity is way down. The water's clear. Underwater grasses seem to be healthy. The crab population has been very robust for the last couple of years. Oysters have bounced back from the brink of extinction just a few years ago.
Right. We can talk a little bit about that, some of the diseases that the oysters confronted. Was it Dermo and I think it was MSX. Yeah.
To microscopic parasites that really did a number on the population. And the oyster population in the Chesapeake was almost inconceivably vast back at the time of the Civil War, say, and became the target of just a pillaging during the late 19th century. The bay was plundered of its oyster population, and so overfishing had been a problem for 75 years by the time these microscopic nasties showed up to seemingly finish the job that oystermen had started. And it was, it looked in the early 80s like the American oyster in the Chesapeake Bay was doomed to completely disappear. It came close.
Hmm.
It came very close. And it's only in the last few years that scientists have detected a resilience, the species has evolved, it appears, not uniformly and not everywhere in the bay, but there are places in the bay where the species appears to be evolving defenses against these predators that are, that they're passing down to their young. And the oyster has made such a comeback that Virginia has reopened its wintertime wild oyster dredging fishery, which if you had asked people 30 years ago what the prospects of that were, I think they would have told you were dreaming.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more too about a little more background about the people on this island. You say they've been populated this Tangier Island since the 1700s, correct?
1778.
Where was their origin?
They were from elsewhere around the bay, most directly. I guess most of the islanders can probably trace their lineage to Cornwall. That seems to be where a good many of them, their family trees, hail from.
Mm-hmm.
The first guy who settled the island was a man named Joseph Crockett. Showed up, built a house on one of the three parallel ridges of sandy loam that rise almost imperceptibly from the marsh on Tangier, and his grandchildren are really the wellsprings for the rest of for the population today. His granddaughters, in particular, are moved onto the island with their husbands and different parts of the island, and you can still see their names. Their surnames reflected that the men they married were Parkses and Pruitts, and those are the two big names now. Joseph Crockett himself, his name is the third most abundant on the island. So it's a place, it's one big extended family.
Yeah.
And that has never changed. It's always been that way. Now, what has changed is that in the last, since the 30s, really, the last 80 years, the population has steadily declined, and it has reached kind of a crisis today. Insofar as it's now a pretty old population. The median age is in the mid to late 50s, and you've got a lot of islanders in their 80s and 90s. No young people staying. Very few islanders of childbearing years remaining on board, and. And so a demographic collapse is looming along with the island's physical dilemma. It's every bit as bad, troubling and vexing as that physical dilemma is.
Right.
So, Earl, what about you? What drew you to this island? You spent 14 months there. And how were you received by the local population?
Well, this is a population that has been a curiosity for journalists for more than a century. And so Tangiermen have become pretty savvy in dealing with reporters over the years. And I think that for probably the first month I was on the island, they assumed I was there to do what most other reporters do, which is show up, spend a couple of days on the island, and leave and write essentially the same story that every other reporter who's ever been there has written, talking about how quaint and lost in time the place is, making note of the odd pattern of, you know, style of speech that islanders have, which is a product of their isolation. And it probably took a month, 6 weeks for them for them to slowly come to the realization that, well, no, wait, I wasn't going anywhere. I was sticking around. And to kind of recalibrate their dealings with me. And, you know, I was spending the same time just kind of showing my face around the island, going to church four times a week. Hmm. You know, it's very close to a working theocracy of old Methodism. And so going to church is absolutely essential to understanding how the island ticks. But, you know, very few reporters spend the night on the island, let alone spend a Saturday night and all day Sunday there so that you can go to church. And they miss out an awful lot of what's necessary to understand the place. I mean, you know, you're on an island in the middle of Chesapeake Bay. Most everything about your day is beyond your control. You know, you're subject to the whims of Mother Nature to a degree that most of us on the mainland can't fathom. No surprise that the Cane Shearmen have relied on faith for their entire existence there, really,
right,
to get them through the day. And it's an extremely important element of island society.
We're speaking with Earl Swift. He's the author of the new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. And in addition to going to church four times a week, I'm sure you were out on the water experiencing crabbing and oystering too.
I was. I did both. Crabbing is much more agreeable weather-wise, I'll tell you that. to go oystering in mid-December when the wind's blowing at 35 miles per hour and you're in 4-foot seas and spray is coming up and, you know, freezing on everything it touches. That's an acquired taste that has you liking that. I never acquired it, but I found it fascinating in crabbing, perhaps even more so because they're interesting animals. They're strange creatures.
Right. So let's now turn our attention to the challenges. You cited some of them, the cultural challenges that the younger demographic is moving off the island. Although at times they've had biological challenges, let's call them, with disease or so, or water pollution, that seems to be on hold right now or improving. But the biggest challenge the island faces is its physical disappearance, which is either occurred, depending on who you talk to, it seems, either a function of sea level rise or simply ongoing erosion of the island. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, if you were to speak to a scientist, and I mean just about every scientist on the planet, there would be no disagreement as to what's going on. What's happening is a product of sea level rise. It is erosion, but these are not mutually exclusive phenomena. They're interlinked. The bay has been on the rise for a long time. There's a point of inflection if you go back and you look at erosion on the Chesapeake and land loss on the Chesapeake. There's a point of inflection that occurs right around 1850, right at the midpoint of the 19th century. Something happened to accelerate the process. And beginning then and accelerating all through the rest of the 19th century, moving into a gallop during the 20th and now moving at breakneck pace, this process of sea level rise and a resulting ferocity in the erosion that occurs on the bay has claimed land at an ever more alarming pace. And what you see on Tangier is an island that is three times the size it is now in 1850, lost an average of 8 acres a year since then, did not have a lot of acres to begin with.
Right.
But now it's down to an area, if you were to include all of the outlying islands and marshy islets, It would be a little smaller than New York Central Park, and all the buildable land on the island, the ridges, as they're called, there, these sandy loam ribs on which houses are built, kind of constitute an island within the island, because they're the only high and dry land you can you can actually occupy. Those would all lumped together be significantly smaller than the reservoir at the middle of Central Park.
Okay.
Wow.
We're not talking about a big piece of land.
Right.
And you know, as the water comes up, as the island's relationship to the water shifts, not only because of that sea level rise, but because of the island's subsidence, which is a byproduct of the last ice age, you know, we're just going to see, you know, if you were to chart what's happening, if you were to chart land loss at Tangier and elsewhere, you know, this is not a straight diagonal line. It's a parabolic curve. It gets worse as you go.
Wow.
And so we're seeing now possibly the end times for the island, unless some truly heroic intervention is undertaken to try to halt it.
Now, the islanders have a different take on what is happening to their island, right, rather than climate change and sea level rise?
They see it as strictly erosion, and they point to the loss of islands in the 19th century as evidence of that view. They say, hey, well, look, there wasn't sea level rise, and, you know, way back in the 1880s when Holland Island started to disappear. And the fact is, well, yeah, there was. We didn't call it that at the time. We didn't recognize it as such. But if you go back and you look at the evidence that was gathered at that point and you view it in the context of what we know today, heck yeah, there was sea level rise, not nearly at the rate it's going on, it's occurring at now, but it was happening. And again, there is a point of inflection in the mid-19th century at which you really see this process kick into gear. And whether that's because that period coincides with the, you know, the Industrial Revolution really getting underway at in a profound way, or whether it's the end of the, you know, the Little Ice Age that figures into it, which lasted a few hundred years and wrapped up at the beginning of the 19th century. Whatever you ascribe it to, the numbers suggest that that's about the, you know, the start for the processes that we're now seeing moving at a breakneck pace.
Right.
You point out that over the past four centuries, more than 500 islands have disappeared from the bay, and about 40 of them were once inhabited. So this is far from the first island to kind of face this set of problems.
Well, of course, not all of them were abandoned because of sea level rise.
Right.
You know, there were some that people just found too lonely and forbidding to live on. But
understandable.
But you bet. You know, if you look around the bay, Holland Island's a great example. It was home to, I think, 231 people in 1900. The erosion from the west, wind-driven waves, of course, helped along by the fact that the water was on the rise, tore away one of the ridges on which people had built their homes. Folks either abandoned the houses or they picked them up and barged them to the mainland or elsewhere. And with that huge piece of the population removed, Holland's economy imploded, and it prompted everybody else to leave. So that we went from 231 people in 1900 to zero by 1919.
Right.
And you see that sort of thing again and again all around the bay. Well, visible from Tangier, 4 miles away, is Watts Island, which once had 20-odd houses, a church, a store. And I visited Watts when I was on a kayak trip around the bay in 1994, and it took me about an hour to walk its perimeter. It took me a good long time. And I saw no signs of its past in habitation. When I went back to Tangier to live in 2016, I was astounded to see that Watts had shrunk to about a third of its size in 1994.
Right.
And it's going fast. You can almost see it get smaller by the day.
So
you know, this process is, it's going to play out on the Chesapeake in a very short amount of time.
Okay, so now let's transition there to potential solutions. What would the islanders like to see happen to, in effect, save this island?
Well, they are facing, as with almost with each day that passes, Chris, the solution would have to be more heroic. I think they would love to see a wall built around the entire island, a riprap armoring of the island's edges, and then they'd like to see dredge spoils pumped into the island's interior to raise its level and buy them a century or more of continued existence. And, you know, that's certainly technically feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Financially, however, it's a tough sell. Insofar as you've got 460 people living on the island, and that number is dropping. And that the price tag for such an operation would run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And there is a proposal on the table. It's a long shot, and I think the Corps of Engineers, which developed this concept, would admit to you that it's a long shot. But rather than save the island for people, which the Corps of Engineers might not be able to justify,
mm-hmm.
There's a chance that they could possibly try to save it for wildlife as habitat being worth more financially than the infrastructure of the town. And if that happened, if they were able to save the island that way, it's possible that they could save the town as a byproduct of saving the birds. Whether they're able to pull that off is a question mark. It's got to go through a lengthy and iffy process,
right,
to win approval and funding.
Well, they haven't had any success, say, with the Army Corps of Engineers under previous administrations. So they actually have much more faith, let's call it, in this current administration and this president, who they supported heavily, being very conservative town. And they believe that this president could, well, in effect, build them a wall.
Well, they certainly hope that's the case. They voted for him to the tune of 88%. I mean, of the 253 votes cast, 221 of them were for Donald Trump. And they did so, despite any concerns they might have had about his personal peccadilloes. They saw him as a guy who could cut through red tape that they felt had mired every promised attempt by the promised effort by the Army Corps of Engineers to come to their rescue. And they figured, hey, here's a guy who knows how to build, is successful in business, can ramrod a solution through so that we're not, waiting for a wall and treading water at the same time. They remain very much Trump supporters. And ever hopeful that he will personally intervene on their behalf.
Right.
Is there an element of faith in this as well? You know, you talk about the deep faith of the population, the community that lives there, and how they see that their faith has gotten them through other hard times. Do you think that there's an element of that with this this idea of saving the island?
Well, I don't know if it's directly related to their support of Donald Trump. But yes, of course, they see themselves as an anointed people, because if you look back through Tangier history, there have been instances upon instances where, by all rights, the island should have been wiped out. I mean, there was a terrible hurricane in 1821. There were outbreaks of various pestilences throughout the 19th century that should have laid the place low. Of course, a host of hurricanes in the 20th century as well, that have really leveled some knockout punches on the place.
Mm-hmm.
And each time, the blow has been just shy of that necessary to keep them down. And so they've come to see themselves as anointed by their faith, armored by the power of prayer. They firmly believe that, and they see see themselves basically in God's hands yet again here, and they are confident that that they will be saved, that their prayer will see them through once more. And whether the agent of that salvation is our current president or the Army Corps of Engineers or whomever, they are confident that it will occur.
Well, after spending 14 months there with these islanders, obviously developing relationships with them and kind of immersing yourself in their culture and daily lives, I know you need to remain objective, but is this? Do you feel like this is an island that's worth saving? Because that's a big question, Earl. Because there are many coastal barrier islands around the country that are confronting the same issues on at different scales and different rates. But is this an island that is worth saving?
Well, that's the whole ball of wax right there. I mean, the fact is that we have 88,000 miles of shoreline. A lot of it is going to be imperiled in the next few years.
Right.
And Tangier is just the first of perhaps thousands of coastal communities that are going to find themselves in this situation. It's the canary in the coal mine. So this is not an isolated case. It's an isolated case right now, but this is something that's coming to a neighborhood near you very soon.
Right.
Now, we know that we don't have the time, the money, or the technical means to save all of the places that will be in peril. So we have to develop, as a people, as a country, a rubric for deciding that very question you ask: what's worth saving? What do we value? What's important to us?
Mm-hmm.
It could be that we do it strictly on the basis of headcount, which would doom an awful lot of smaller places that we consider important, as Americans, that have been key to our history or that are key to our culture, or that we just liked, that we, for whatever reason, places like Jamestown or Yorktown,
right.
Any number of places like that, any beach resort, you name it, it's part of that. It's going to be one of those smaller towns that will bite the dust if we decide we're only going to save places with a certain critical mass of human presence. So we have to develop this yardstick we have to come up with a way to quantify value, quantify importance.
Right.
And and it's going to be an ugly process. Deciding what to save won't be as hard as deciding how to decide, and it's going to require much smarter people than me. So should Tangier be saved? I don't know. Do I love the place? Would I love to see it saved? Of course.
Yeah.
Unique is a word that we throw around a lot, but this is truly a unique place in the American landscape. There is no other town like it. There's no other. It's developed its own language, for goodness sake. I think that it would make us a little less interesting as a country to not have it helping to define the outer limits, the breadth of what it means to be an American.
Well, the name of the book is Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. The author is Earl Swift. And Earl, thanks again so much for taking the time to join us. Do you have a website or a blog you want to pitch?
Well, my website is earlswift.com.
All right.
And you can find all my books and other stuff there.
All right. Perfect.
Fantastic.
It's a great book. Interesting, fascinating read. And thank you again so much for taking the time to chat
thank
with us this
so
morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of This Green Earth. Special thanks to our supporters and underwriters who make this show possible. You can email Nell and Chris your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. The interviews from today's show will be posted on the KPCW website later today. You can also listen to This Green Earth as a podcast in your favorite podcast app of choice, and you can search for KPCW in your favorite podcast app for all of KPCW's public affairs shows. Thanks for listening. This is KPCW Park City.